WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Screenwriter and director Whit Stillman looks back on the nightlife of the early 80s in his new romantic comedy, The Last Days of Disco. It follows a group of single people as they look for friendship and love at an exclusive Manhattan disco. In this scene, a young assistant DA is talking with a friend at a coffee shop about why he loves disco.
I was just starting law school when the first up-tempo Philadelphia International hits broke. Some people don't consider that disco because it's good, but I remember feeling absolutely electrified.
You feel electrified often?
No, but this was different. I loved the idea that there'd be all these great places for people to go dancing after the terrible social wasteland of our college years.
Oof. You've been to a lot of discos?
No. In fact, practically none. For me, law school wasn't easy, and I haven't had much of a social life since coming to the city either, but I still consider myself a loyal adherent to the disco movement.
It's a movement?
Sort of. What I found terribly encouraging was the idea that when the time in life came to have a social life, there'd be all these great places for people to go to, because, as you'll remember, for many years, there were none. What I didn't realize is that it gets so impossible to get into.
Filmmaker Whit Stillman started going to dance clubs when he was a teenager, traveling in Europe in the late 60s, and picked up with them again here in the late 70s. Stillman considers The Last Days of Disco the conclusion in a trilogy of his films about young single people and their group social life. Metropolitan was about debutantes and their escorts, Barcelona about Americans living in Europe. Stillman told me why he wanted to set his new film in the disco era.
It was when I was in the throes of trying to find the right significant other, the way the characters in the film are. It was the sort of apex of our single social life. And I think it's rare in our country when we have places and moments when groups of young people congregate after college. I think we often live sort of solitary social lives where there's a date and dinner and a movie or a party, but a place where you can semi-anonymously go and run into people you like or meet new people is not something we always have.
It's the ambition of some of the characters in The Last Days of Disco just to be admitted to the club. And some of the characters are so angry and insulted that they can't get in, or even worse, that they've been thrown out, that they compare the bouncers and the guards to the Nazis. I'm thinking you must have felt ambivalent about a club scene where only the beautiful people get let in, where you have to, like, look right and be the right age and so on in order to just get admitted.
Well, I think it's more of extremes, so you could sort of play the extremes. And also, I think there are times when it wasn't very hard to get in. I think if you go the peak time when everyone else is, it's like a traffic jam, and you don't get in. But there were ways of slipping in different moments, you know, early in the evening, very late in the evening, the back door, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that it was justified in some of those clubs because it really worked in the sense they created a party atmosphere inside. Unfortunately, the party invitation list was done right at the door, so it was cruel that way. But it was very easy also to pretend that I didn't really want to go. And, you know, maybe it's better we go to Rex's and have a drink. And so, I mean, I don't think we should read too much into the rejection. For one of the characters, it's part of his career. He feels that if he doesn't get people into the club, he's going to lose his job because there's been a merger in his ad agency. We don't really talk about that. He's the last of the old regime. And he feels if he can't get the clients in or the top brass of the agency in, they're going to let him go.
Whit Stillman, are you a good dancer?
I think so. But it was pretty embarrassing in our premiere, and there are a lot of photographers, and they wanted me to dance with Chloe and Tara Subkoff, and I'm afraid whatever skills I had disappeared at that moment.
Is there a connection between the disco era and the debutante era for you? And by that, I mean your first film, Metropolitan, is about a group of people in their late teens, I'd say. Late teens, is that about right? Mid-teens?
Yeah, it's kind of specific in Metropolitan because most of the women would be between 17 and 19, and the guys would be that age plus a little bit older. And so there might be a two-year age difference between the guys and the women.
And the story is about debutantes and their male escorts. And I'm wondering if the friends you had in like the deb days are the same friends you had in the disco days, or whether those were two completely separate groups of people.
Well, they were different people from the same subgroup. There was some overlap, and I think, you know, it's a good question, because there was, I think, the feeling of recreating the Deb days in the discos, and there was a very strong element of that in the Red Velvet Rope clubs. I think people, if they had to go to some dress-up party where they had to wear a black tie, they would think, well, let's try to go to studio afterwards because maybe we'll get in if we're dressed this way. So we now become sort of special and extreme because we're all dressed up and maybe we'll be able to get in. And so I think there's a feeling of that same alcohol-fueled, heightened romance, experience of life, late at night. You lose sort of perspective in a nice way and can have a very good time.
I think one of the things that interests me about your movies, they're not about bohemians. You know, these are people who dress up, whether it's the disco era or the debutante era. And I have to admit, I never knew people when I was in my teens and 20s who voluntarily wore formal attire, men or women. I never knew people who owned tuxedos or even had occasions to rent them. Yeah. And none of the women I knew when I was young had formal dresses in their closets either. You wouldn't have needed it for anything.
Well, I think it's interesting you mentioned the word bohemians, because I think they're bohemians in their heads. And that's what I think I liked about this group, that they were the people I met, and I had an unusual experience maybe, and maybe I would have not made Metropolitan if I hadn't fallen in with a group of people who were very friendly and funny and charming and bohemian and kind of unusual.
Kind of intellectual.
And they appreciated eccentricity. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who were not at all from that world who were attracted to it like moths to a candle. And they were odd types, often very funny and eccentric. And there was kind of a gay overlap, I think, in both worlds, which was a positive thing. And I noticed that a lot of the reactions to the movie and to the world of Metropolitan and the world of the disco is the same thing. I think there's a kind of a wet blanket approach where social life is not good and parties are not good. And I remember in the 70s, everyone saying, oh, I hate cocktail parties. Oh, I hate cocktail parties. Everyone said that. Still, people attended cocktail parties. And I have to say that I absolutely love cocktail parties. I think they're fantastic. And I really like parties of all kinds. And I think that the films really are about the idea of a party. And these nightclubs, when they're successful, were a party. And that was what was so good about them. And the debutante parties, when they sort of existed organically and were actually about real people who kind of knew each other or got to know each other, they became parties in the good sense. And I think parties are good, not bad. And I remember getting very upset with a friend when I didn't get invited to a baby christening, of all things. And I was very upset. And I was thinking, well, I'm not going to talk to them anymore and blah, blah, blah. And I mentioned this to another friend who had gone. I said, well, you don't understand. There are only like 15 people there. And I realized that I'd been completely mistaken, that I was not within his group of 15 closest friends, and why should I be there? And I started thinking that, really, if people want to or do not want to invite you to a party or include you in something, you should accept that and like it when you want to go, and not be offended or upset when you don't go. So I really try hard. If I'm not invited to some premiere that I'm interested in, that's no skin off my nose. I mean, that's fine. People should have whatever party they want.
What do you like about parties?
Everything. I can work away. That's just too much, Terry. It'd be several shows. I think there is the...
Not everybody would respond that way.
Obviously not. I think there is just something exciting about meeting new people and seeing old friends. Perhaps it's alcohol-fueled. There's a sense of sort of release of this sort of extroverted making contact with people, and people ridicule a line in the film when the Josh character talks about the exchanges of ideas and points of view. But that is part of the attraction of a party. My wife was amazed by American cocktail parties. She knew nothing like them in Spain, because she said there's so much information being exchanged. People talk about all kinds of things, and it was sort of like microwave data transfers of people just blurting out all kinds of things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Whit Stillman. His new movie is The Last Days of Disco. He also wrote and directed Metropolitan and Barcelona. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Whit Stillman, he wrote and directed the new movie The Last Days of Disco. He also wrote and directed Metropolitan, which was about a group of friends during the period when they're going to debutante parties. Now, you make films about the children of the privileged class.
No, they're not a privileged class.
They're not a privileged class.
We got rid of privileges in this country, I think, in 1810. I think the last ancestral estates were voted out by the New York State Legislature around then. James Fenimore Cooper was very upset about it.
To put it in other words, one of your characters does, you make films about the children of the haute bourgeoisie.
Okay.
You like that better?
I like someone who commented on the penuriousness of the characters, that they're not necessarily rich, that maybe there was money several generations ago or the memory of money, and now it's about something else.
Do you think that people who are from that class, either the upper class or that just have the memory of money, do you think that they're treated badly in pop culture?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really like they're going to put them in camps and re-educate them. And it's really shocking. I didn't see the entire movie Titanic, but I think it was pretty immoral.
Pretty immoral?
Yeah, I think it was, because they're essentially dancing on the grave of very honorable people. The people on the ship, a lot of them behaved very, very well. They were very honorable in the way they died. And to have some, you know, jerk from Hollywood maligning those people, I think was really disgraceful.
Oh, maligning them because they were rich.
Yeah, that kind of misrepresentation. I mean, I think it's hateful when people destroy the humanity of other people based on externals. And I think it's hateful when it's done for reasons of race or ethnic group. But also, I think people feel that they have a free pass when it's class. So if they can identify the people as a class in the upper range of the spectrum, then they're free to hate and, you know, kill yuppie scum, which is, you know, kind of a joke when people write kill yuppie scum. But I think there's a lot of that emotion floating out there.
Now, I think your grandfather was president of First National City Bank, which is now Citibank. Your father was a lawyer and Democratic County chair.
My grandfather actually was a research physician. He worked at the Rockefeller Institute.
Oh.
He was a doctor, and I think a forming influence in his life was the Spanish flu epidemic after the war that killed so many people. So he spent his life researching that. And his father was the president of Citibank. Back then.
I see.
So it was my great-grandfather.
Did you have what you've described as the memory of money in your family?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And having a divorce in the family also meant that there's more of a separation. And for me, it was very positive, because I think you get in very bad habits of mind when there's inherited money in a family. I think it's a very negative thing for people to deal with. And being released from that when my parents got divorced, I think was a positive growth experience, as we'd say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you like downwardly mobile after the divorce?
I was very dramatically downwardly mobile.
What was the experience like of having the culture and worldview of a class that you no longer had the money to fit into?
Well, I'm not sure if there is a culture and worldview of the class. I mean, it's a grab bag of all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I think what separates Tobacco Road from Park Avenue is sometimes very thin. And I think that the upper middle class is actually much more interesting and amusing and sort of pathetic than would be represented in a James Cameron movie. I think there's a lot of the lost souls who have enough money from some family connection never really to take the right chances and to touch bottom and to kind of build their own life and their own careers. There are sort of companies that don't really exist and jobs that are kind of mythical. And I admire the will and the dedication of those people who can rise up beyond a trust fund to do creative, productive things, even though there's this huge incentive for them to live in a kind of a world of illusion where they just keep up appearances and try to sound interesting. And
one of the characters in Metropolitan, your movie about debutantes and their escorts, has to rent a tuxedo and wear a shabby raincoat over it instead of a Brooks Brothers overcoat. Were you in that position?
I was. I mean, there was actually probably, you know, more resources than that character had, but that was the psychological feeling. That was exactly how it felt. And what I think I liked about it was that rather than just being the kind of person going on family vacations, just tagging along with my family, I was in a situation where it was incumbent on me, I think, to make friends and to social climb, essentially, that I would be the friend who'd go along on the vacation, the cousin who'd be brought along as sort of entertainment for the other kids. And it imposes sort of a discipline. You have to start dealing with other people in a positive way and being positive rather than negative, adding something to the equation, not just taking. And it is good preparation for the film business. You end up being in a situation where you're kind of the unwanted guest in a lot of groups.
What's the difference between being a date and being an escort? I don't really understand the process, so maybe you can describe it a little
bit. Well, a girl would call, and I had a friend who was in the same orbit I was, and so girls could call either him or me and ask if we'd be their escorts, because normally there are two guys and one girl. And sometimes it was a mother who would call and say, would you be my daughter's escort to such and such a party? Or sometimes a girl would call, and we'd be sort of a package deal. We'd go sort of together. And it created this feeling of social life in a group where we're all there as friends, and we weren't stuck with each other. There wasn't sort of the identity crisis that we're committing to one person for this evening. We were all there together, and I think a lot of these outdated social processes had their charms and their virtues. And it's kind of amazing that they continue so strongly in those places where they existed before.
What were the sexual expectations if you were an escort? Did that mean that you were going to have a passionate kiss goodnight or not?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
No, I don't think you would.
Right. So all the kind of like sexual kind of like fears and insecurities around first dates wouldn't exist if you were an escort, or wouldn't exist as much?
Absolutely not, no. And once I went in a situation which was not like that, and it acquired the atmosphere of a first date and sort of a blind date, and that wasn't so good. But normally I think that group feeling really was positive. And of course, as represented in the film Metropolitan, after the sort of dances week, there was orgy week. And that was the week we hung out together in people's apartments when there weren't parties. And that's when things got passionate.
Right. In the movie Metropolitan, the more downwardly mobile character thinks of himself as a committed socialist, and he says he goes to the Deb parties because he wants to see and understand that which he opposes. The fact is he's really enjoying those parties and really enjoying the people that he's meeting there. Did you feel that you needed to have some kind of intellectual excuse when you went to the Deb parties?
Yeah, absolutely. And also just to have a social life, because in sort of straitened circumstances, moving back to the city without really knowing anyone here, it was the one way of having a social world and a social life. And I went with all those sort of attitudes of the Fourierist socialist. I mean, I was reading Robert Hobrunner's book, The Summer Before College, and each chapter about some arcane socialist of the last century, I would sort of be converted to their ideology. And my parents were left liberals in politics, and so it came very much naturally. And I went with all those sort of chip-in-the-shoulder attitudes I sort of decry and make fun of elsewhere, and had to sort of get over it myself. I had to sort of drop all that because it was so hypocritical.
Did you change your politics or change your social goals when the two were incompatible?
Well, what I tried to take out of my politics was something that we had in our family, which I think was sort of a character flaw, which was not only were we liberal Democrats and involved in politics and government. I think it's really the politics my parents preferred rather than just the government. And but with that went a whole sort of array of attitudes of we're supposed to despise Republicans and Episcopalians and golf players and country clubbers and conventional social people and people who went to Edgartown instead of Chilmark. And there's a whole sort of laundry list of things we were supposed not to like. And becoming an adult and really seeing the way people were and falling in love a little bit with the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, finding that a lot of these upper middle class people I was supposed to despise were actually very kind and generous and nice. I had to drop that and not hate people based on, you know, their club affiliation or what sport they play.
My guest is Whit Stillman. He wrote and directed the new movie, The Last Days of Disco. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Whit Stillman, he wrote and directed the new film The Last Days of Disco. It concludes the trilogy of films that he began with Metropolitan about young single people and their group social life. You didn't start making movies until you were, I think, in your mid or late 30s. And I'm wondering if you tried different types of writing before you tried making movies.
I did, and I was really in a trap because nothing quite worked. I gave up writing so many times. And I only came back to it with the idea of getting a cheap script to direct so I could prove myself as a director and maybe get other directing jobs later.
Yeah, and Metropolitan was really cheap. How much did that cost?
Well, it started out, the dream was to make it for $50,000, which is...
outrageous.
And then it, of course, creeped up from there.
Uh-huh.
And I think that to get it out of the laboratory cost $230,000, and then we paid about another $70,000 in deferments.
What were you trying to write when you were writing fiction? Books or short stories?
Well, in my first career path was to follow my father into politics, to be a lawyer and work in Democratic politics. I became disillusioned with that and infatuated with novels such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I wanted to write Fitzgerald-esque novels and tried fiction in college. Then I became more interested in humorous short story writers such as Isaac Bashevis Singer and J.D. Salinger and novelists like Jane Austen. And I tried to write humorous fiction. It was terribly limited because I'd always have a comical, ridiculous first-person narrator, and I have to sort of invent an apparatus for introducing this person and then have them tell the story, which is terribly limited and sort of precious. I hated description. And to try to make description interesting, I'd sort of write parody description, which became sort of intense and overwritten, occasionally funny, but impossible to read. And it was a huge release to find the comedy screenplay format where every character is a ridiculous first-person narrator, and they're going to be played by actors who are going to be up there on the screen and have to take most of the blame. And that you can have a lot of non sequitur and jumping around, and you don't have to describe anything. The camera does that. So it released a lot of my inhibitions, but it still takes me about 2 or 3 years to write one.
Well, I love the kind of dialogue you write, and I was thinking that in some ways you're the opposite of David Mamet, whose dialogue I also love, in the sense that he gets to how people speak by kind of paring it down to its essential music, you know, to its like minimal music. And he also writes for very streetwise kind of characters very often. And your writing gets to how people speak, but you do it by writing more elaborately than they speak. Instead of stripping it down, you're kind of adding on to it. You're adding like more words and more descriptions than any articulate person could possibly pull off in real life. And I think, and it's also very entertaining, the dialogue you write. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to dialogue?
I don't know. I try to have it all talkable and like people talk. I think the objective is naturalism, to be truthful. And I guess I know a lot of people who talk that way. And I was really pleased.
Kind of hyper-literate people?
I don't know. Maybe they just take phrases that they've read and plump them into sentences and form their sentences that way. I guess that the problem is what takes it from naturalism to something stylized is that there's so much material I like to get in the movies. There's so much to be said, to be discussed, and that does change the realism of those scenes, I guess.
Do you know what your next film is going to be?
I do. The title I'm still trying to keep under wraps because I don't want this situation where everyone else has the same film coming out in 4 years. It's set in the, I guess there's not much chance of that because I want to set it during the American Revolution. And I really want to go to a different phase. I love doing these three movies and I hope they'll all stand up to public scrutiny. But now I want to go and do historical films and the American Revolution will be the setting for the first one.
Why the American Revolution?
I've always been interested in it. I love the 18th century. I love the way people wrote then and their thought. I think that we owe a lot of the political success of our country to the good thinking of that period. And I, growing up, had sort of adventure heroes from that period, and I'd like to make a quasi-adventure film. I know it's a bit of a stretch, and people consider it implausible, and I might not get immediate financing. But I was obsessed with history in childhood, and I think that as an adult, you can reach back into the past and take those things you cared about as a child, even if they were your own experience, and invest the film with more feeling and emotion than you could if it was just a directorial assignment. I think Steven Spielberg did a wonderful job with that early in his career when he takes subjects he obviously felt very close to from youth and adolescence.
This will be the first time that you're getting away from the kinds of stories that you know through your own life, because you're writing about people who are basically your friends and yourself. So are you looking forward to kind of breaking with semi-autobiography?
I'm looking forward to that. It's kind of dangerous because one of the good things you can do if you're writing from personal experience is you can make it very specific and very, I think, new in a way. While when you go into experience that is not your own, it becomes very generic and stereotyped and a little bit dull. And I think that we have to have characters who are plausible from that period, who are living, exciting characters who change in the course of it, just the same process of trying to write one of these contemporary scripts or semi-contemporary scripts.
Whit Stillman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Whit Stillman wrote and directed the new film, The Last Days of Disco.